Welcome to Commons and Chronicles, the podcast where we talk about all the best Creative Commons and reusable open game license content. If you need resources for your creative writing, game design, or you just love lore, Commons and Chronicles is for you. Have you ever seen Ralph Bakshi's Wizards or Fire and Ice? Or have you seen the movie Heavy Metal? Or maybe you've visited Eternia, where Prince Adam becomes He-Man in the times of need to conquer the evil Skeletor. If any of these settings are familiar to you, then you know that there's the common thread through these, that they're fantasy worlds with science fiction technology. I feel like back in, I guess, maybe the 70s, possibly during the 80s, I'm not really sure, I haven't really tracked it, but I feel like there was a point at which there wasn't really a set expectation yet about what fantasy was and what science fiction was, and it was all kind of lumped together, sci-fi fantasy or just speculative fiction, as we sometimes still call it. No one knew what the rules were, and so the authors of this content would play pretty fast and loose with what are now fairly strict genres. And this pops up in the examples I've just mentioned, but in other places too. If you've ever read Jack Vance's Dying Earth, that's a great example. It's set in the far, far future, but reading it generally feels like it's a fantasy novel. We saw it in Frank Herbert's Dune as well, where it's clearly a science fiction universe, and yet there's this central theme of magic, or at least psionics. And I guess in even more popular culture, bringing it really out of the realm of the back aisle of the bookstore where they keep all the science fiction and fantasy paperbacks, there's Star Wars, which borrowing heavily, presumably from Dune, you've got the same kind of situation, except instead of into the far, far future, it's in the far, far past. But there's that strong sense of magic within your very obviously science fiction setting. I don't know how well role-playing games have reflected that sense of freewheeling fantasy sci-fi blend. It doesn't tend to be pretty common, I don't think. It does happen, obviously, but in the RPG world, as with movies and video games, really, it and books, it seems that the modern day mindset is that you can either have a fantasy world or you can have a science fiction world, and you're allowed to like both, but you're not supposed to mix the two together. It's kind of a little bit strange that we've gone in that direction, especially since, at least as far as I can tell, a lot of the audience for fantasy and for science fiction, they actually cross over a lot. Not always. There are the parts of that Gantt chart that do not intersect, and that's fine. But it's kind of interesting that the part that does intersect seems to have gotten smaller and smaller and smaller, both in what's available and the people who appear to want that sort of crossover. It's hard to say which is the cause and which is the effect, or maybe it's a mutual effect. Who knows? Point is, I feel like a lot of people want, when they sit down at the RPG table, they expect a fantasy setting. Or maybe some people expect a science fiction setting. But I think even stronger is that kind of classic experience of, I want to play a fantasy RPG. And I don't know if that's because we see that on TV and we hear about it from friends, just because Dungeons and Dragons as a with its primary setting being a fantasy world, maybe that's just what most people who are seeking to get into it, that's the seed that is planted into their head. And so when they go to play the game, that's what they expect. That's what they want in order, that's what they want to experience, because that's what they've heard about. That's what has intrigued them. You just don't hear that much about science fiction role-playing. And frankly, I'm one of those people. When I sit down at an RPG table, if I have the choice, 7 times out of 10, I'm going to take fantasy. Just because that is, for me, the classic role-playing genre. That's the thing that I want to experience. Because it's the thing that I got introduced to. That, for me, is the RPG experience. So there's a lot of sort of nostalgia and familiarity and comfort in that fantasy setting. At the same time, there's a lot of nostalgia and familiarity and comfort with many of the examples that I mentioned at the top of the episode. He-Man, maybe if you grew up in the 80s or grew up around the 80s, then you probably know of He-Man. If you, and I think there was actually a reboot recently as well, not quite the same, but it exists. Maybe you've seen some of the wacky animated films or read some of the really crazy Jack Vance books. Whatever your introduction to this idea, this concept of there being laser guns in a fantasy setting, it's a really fun twist on something that we all thought we knew pretty well, which is the fantasy world. I feel like the farther you stray from the traditional introductory fantasy of J.R.R. Tolkien, the more tolerant you become of this idea of, in a high magic setting, there may as well be technology. Because the two, as Arthur C. Clarke famously wrote, are basically indistinguishable. And that's what I want to look at in this episode. And I'll take another look at sort of some technology or a technological heavy setting soon as well. But in this episode, I want to talk specifically about a Paizo product called, quite simply, Technology Guide. It was released as a Pathfinder campaign setting. It is about 68 pages long, so it's for a Paizo book, I think of that as being a relatively short book. It was released, as far as I know and as far as I recall, around the same time as the Iron Gods campaign. So the Iron Gods campaign is an adventure path put out by Paizo. I think it contains 6 books, which I think most of their adventure paths typically do. I feel like that's true. 6 books, about 100 pages each, so it's a pretty major work, really, altogether. If you go through the entire thing, it's a 600-page adventure, a 600-page campaign. Will definitely keep your gaming group busy, or if you're just reading it for ideas and for fun and for discovery, it'll keep you reading for a while. It's a big book, or a big set of books. And the Iron Gods campaign, the idea behind it, I don't feel like I'm giving too much away here by simply saying that, because you kind of get the feel for it if you pick up the book in the bookstore. It's right there on the front cover and on the back cover, and certainly within the first couple of pages, you get the idea pretty quickly that Iron Gods campaign, as even its name suggests, is a book about technology in the fantasy world of Galarian, which is the default world of, or the default setting for Pathfinder. And make no mistake, this isn't Spelljammer-style technology where they take the idea of a fantasy world and send them into a fantasy outer space where you're sort of sailing between these crystal spheres on this great flotsam of space, where you can breathe and there's gravity and it's very Jules Verne sort of outer space interpretation. No, this is technology. This is future technology from an advanced civilization. The center of advanced technology on Galarian is a place called Numeria, and none of this, none of the campaign setting stuff, none of that lore is open game content. So I'm not going to really talk about how or why the technology enters this campaign. I'm simply going to talk about the technology and how it interacts with a game and how it affects a fantasy world, because I think that sort of thing is an interesting and somewhat unique prospect. I mean, it's not wholly unique, because, as I say, there were things like Ralph Bakshi's fantasy movies and Jack Vance's Dying Earth setting and He-Man and probably lots of other examples that I'm not thinking of. But it is still somewhat unique. It's something that not everyone does anymore, at least. So it's something that bringing that into a story could set things apart a little bit. There is an interesting parallel as well between the technology guide of Pathfinder to the system that came out about 2 years later from the same company called Starfinder. I've been playing a little bit of Starfinder here and there when I can, and the parallels are pretty cool, actually, because you start seeing things in Pathfinder the science fiction, the pure science fiction setting that maybe you knew about from the crossover of science fiction and fantasy in Pathfinder. So that's been kind of interesting. The technology guide, though, which is available as either in a hard copy or you can get it as a PDF from paizo.com, the technology guide goes into how you can integrate technology into your fantasy world, and it does so in a surprisingly frank way. It says what I've kind of assumed for a very long time, which oddly seems to throw a lot of people for a complete loop, and that is that since technology is so much like magic, honestly, to most of us, I mean, you may or may not understand a lot about technology, but at a certain point, harnessing powers of electricity in such a way that it triggers virtual switches, binary switches on a CPU in such a number that instruction sets can be built around this response, and then that response itself controls a kernel, and that kernel controls your operating system, and so on, even if it is just a small device. That, to really most of us, that is magic. That may as well be something that happens without any explanation, because the explanation is so far from our understanding that until you go to school and study it and really, really learn about electrical engineering and then about programming and all that stuff that it's dependent upon, it may as well be magical. And so it states in the introduction in the technology guide that since it is so much like magic, you can basically treat it as magic. And so the idea of a destruction laser beam really is no different than a disintegrate spell, for instance. A death ray is basically a destruction spell with a few flavor tweaks and rule adjustments. That's a quote straight from the book. And furthermore, you can skin things one way or the other such that you can use technology in your campaign without using technology, or you can use magic in your campaign but turn it into technology. For instance, maybe you want some way to hack into a robot and control it yourself. Well, if you're in a technology setting and you have someone who can specialize in hacking, then you call it hacking. If you don't, then you create a magic wand called the Rod of Construct Control, and you use the stats on page 51 of the technology guide for the RoboJack. And the examples are endless. Every technological feature introduced in the technology guide could be skinned as pure magic, and several of the existing pure magic systems or items could be reskinned to be very clever technological items. There are no new skills introduced in the technology guide, so this is you get the technology essentially for free, although that said, there are some skill expansions that get introduced to deal with some of the very specific technology concerns. So for instance, the craft skill gets a new concentration, craft mechanical, which is an intelligence-based check, and it ensures that the player is able to craft hinges and gears and pulleys, but also deal with modern technology, or science fiction technology, I should say. There are some feats accompanying that on page 6 of the technology guide. And those feats aren't too shabby, really. They're kind of cool. For instance, you have a craft cybernetics. You can build cyberware and install it into a creature's body, so you can have cyborgs. Prerequisites are that you are a technologist, that you have 9 ranks in healing, and 9 ranks in knowledge engineering. And the benefit to this feat is that you can create cybernetic items. Creating a cybernetic item takes 1 day for every 1,000 gold pieces in the item's price. To create the object, you must use up raw materials costing half of this total price. See Crafting High-Tech Items on page 16, and so on. You can also repair broken cybernetic items if it is one that you can make. Doing so costs half the raw materials and half the time it would take to craft one from scratch. So that's your basic sort of self-sufficient cybernetic introduction into your game. You can also do a craft pharmaceuticals, and it's similar. Again, 9 ranks in heal, 9 ranks in knowledge nature that time, and then you've got the same kind of crafting rules. It takes time and it takes money. Pharmaceuticals obviously is the tech version of the magical potions that are pretty common in a fantasy game. I think you would probably want to have one or the other, I imagine. I mean, it feels weird to me to have magic potions and then to also have a technological or scientific explanation for those, because then your technology does start to break down science, or rather, it starts to break down magic. It starts to erode on the magicfulness of everything. Whereas if your technology is really just magic packaged up nice and tidy, then I feel like that's a little bit different. But I mean, you could also spin it differently. You know, maybe the method of making a pharmaceutical does involve magic, or maybe the magic that was used to make these magical potions all along was actually just a form of science. So it's not a huge stretch, and I really enjoy the idea of mixing those things together. I really do like that, because it makes magic a little bit more approachable. Or, seen a different way, it makes science a little bit less approachable, which that's never really been a problem for me, so that's not really how I think of it. There's also a feat for crafting technological arms and armor, so you can make your high-tech weapons. And then there's things like craft a technological item, Robot's Bane, where you can get around the robot's attack mechanisms, so you have better defense against robots. Scavenger's Luck, using time-worn technology, roll twice to determine a glitch effect. Technologist, you can use the technology skills, so that's the base dependency. Technophobe, gain a morale bonus when you destroy a robot or technological item. Technology Adept, gain a bonus on save DCs to resist the effects of technological firearms. And then finally, Rest Charge, jury rig a depleted battery to hold one last charge. Very, very useful skills that integrate technology into your game really easily by by just providing a set of feats. So it's not even a new class or anything. It's just something that someone can take and become an expert in this foreign technology or in this future technology that they've stumbled upon, or that you've just introduced as part of your setting. And I really like that it highlights the modularity of the Pathfinder system, which I've always liked. And that's exactly what you want when you're just tacking on something new to your setting. It's perfect that all you have to do is take a few new feats, introduce a couple new spells for your casters, and a new line of equipment, and you're done. It's now you've got a hybrid fantasy sci-fi world. Okay, so that was the crafting sort of. There's also, I mean, it was a lot more than crafting actually, but that's the those are the feats anyway. There are also other little minor modifications to things like the disable device, which is of course normally a dex check. It is still a dex check. AC penalty may be imposed whilst disabling the device, and it's a trained skill. So with the technologist feat, you can now use disable device to arm or disarm high-tech explosives or disable electronic triggers and locks. So you become more or less, I guess you could say, a hacker or a specialist with this science fiction technology, and all you have to do is grab the technologist feat, and you inherit the added ability of disable device applying to really purely electronic things, which I think, yeah, there's definitely an argument that a rogue who can disable really cool mechanical traps, maybe even magical traps, maybe they wouldn't be able to just figure out how to do an electronic trap or an electronic door with a computer and a keypad or whatever. There's a linguistics modification. That's intelligence trained only. A character with the technologist feat can attempt a linguistics check to decipher certain complex messages that appear in Numerian runes. Of course, Numerian is not open game content. It's part of the setting. The idea here, though, is that there is a secret language within the world, within this setting. And because it is a secret language, it is largely why it is sort of the reason. Well, there are two reasons. One is the Technology League, but the other reason is that this language simply doesn't, or the Technic League rather, simply does not. No one knows the language, so the secrets of technology are wrapped up in this language. And I think there's quite a lot of there's an analogy there to the real world, because if I showed you some C++ code and told you that it was really, really easy to create a simple calculator, it may or may not actually work for you unless you have linguistics training as a technologist and you could read this computer language, and then maybe you would see how easy it actually was. So I like that one because it does assume that there's a little bit of a secret knowledge insofar as it's very, very specialized. Or maybe it is secret. In the Pathfinder world, the assumption is that it is a guarded secret, that they do not spread the knowledge of technology. And there are other books and settings with that premise, definitely. So it's kind of a tried and tested old trope. There are some knowledge check modifications or clarifications in some case. For instance, knowledge arcana cannot be used to identify robots or their abilities and weaknesses, which is not intuitive because a robot is a construct, and that is true. It specifically says robots are constructs, but you still can't use knowledge arcana because presumably the robot is not driven by arcana. It is driven by something else. Knowledge engineering is the most important skill in the technology, on the technology side of things, because you can use that actually to look at robots, to figure out that they are a robot, to figure out weaknesses, and so on. Astronomy is a knowledge geography check, for lack of, well, knowledge astronomy, I guess. There are some new spells that Pathfinder suggests, which I quite like, because once again, if we're melding technology and magic in many ways, although not in all ways, right? Because the knowledge arcana can't tell you about a robot, even though it can tell you about constructs. But in many ways, they're kind of on the same, they're in the same area as each other. So having spells that are specific to technology, I think, is rather important, because a lot of people, when they think of bringing science fiction technology into a fantasy world, they think of the worst case scenario, or of the modern day scenario, really, of bringing a shotgun back to the fantasy world, which of course Pathfinder already accounts for. They have a gunslinger class that they introduce in, I think, Advanced Players, maybe, I forget, but they allow gunplay in the fantasy world, so that does exist. But a lot of people can't get their heads around that, and they think, well, if you brought back a shotgun, you'd dominate. The game's over. And that's because I think that most of us picture everything happening now for some reason. I mean, I don't know why we do that, but I think it is our tendency. We think, well, a fantasy world is like the Middle Ages, right? Okay, so we just assume everything's like the Middle Ages. And then now is now, so we're pretty familiar with that. So we think of taking a gun from now and going back into the Middle Ages of now, and then shooting a knight, and the bullet would certainly go right through the armor and kill the person. But in a fantasy world, which is not Middle Ages of the planet Earth, there's no reason to assume that the quality of the metal of armor would have been as poor in this fantasy world as the quality of metal on the planet Earth in the Middle Ages. There's no reason to assume that at all, or that the quality of the metal of the bullets would be so far superior to armor that it would not pierce the metal. So I never really understood the dissonance between a fantasy world and modern technology, but this kind of strengthens that. So if you're having a hard time getting your head around how a laser gun could possibly not kill someone immediately, and yet you're okay with the idea of burning hands or acid arrow or all of these other ridiculous spells not killing someone immediately, then I think that these anti-technology spells kind of help assuage some of that uncertainty. So for instance, there is an anti-tech field, which it's an abjuration spell, and it requires a druid level 6 or a sorcerer and wizard level 7, 10-foot radius. It is a field that suppresses any technological effect. Now, it doesn't end or negate that effect, but it does suppress it for as long as the field is in duration. Another good one is the destroy robot spell, which is a transmutation for druids 5 or sorcerers and wizards of level 6. You attempt to destroy any one robot in range. When you cast the spell, your hand crackles with electricity. You must succeed at a ranged touch attack to affect the target. The target takes 12d6 points of damage plus 1 per caster level, or 3d6 of damage plus 1 point per caster level on a successful saving throw. And that is a fortitude spell, saving throw for the robot. So that's a great one. That's an automatic shutdown command, right? Detect radiation. It's always handy in a science fiction setting. There's a kind of power drain. I think it's called, discharge, and another abjuration spell. And it's a pretty low level one. Bard 3, cleric 3, magus 3, sorcerer wizard 3, witch 3. And it just drains the power of something. It reduces the power from a battery, from a robot or a weapon or whatever you whatever you affect. There's a irradiate spell. So in other words, this is a system to enable magic and technology to fight in the same world and to negate one another as needed. And I think it is needed. It's something that you absolutely have to do in order to well, level the playing field, I guess, but also just to make it that much more believable, because it is difficult sometimes to imagine a world where people could be running around in wizard robes, shot by a laser gun, and not die immediately. This helps remind people, I think, that in Dungeons & Dragons, that's not how things work. And it's not just the fact that, okay, you've got this magic that can protect you from technology, necessarily. I mean, there is armor that I'll touch on pretty soon here. But there's also just the concept, and this, for new players especially, I think, and even experienced players, sometimes the reminder and the clarification, just sort of speaking it into being, is important. And that the idea that when you hit someone's AC, it doesn't necessarily mean that you've even, arguably it doesn't even mean that you've physically hit them. It simply means that you've just expended, or it can mean, that you've just expended some of their, shall we say, some of their luck. This is arguable, and it's open to interpretation, but that's kind of how I've seen it for a while now. And that is, sometimes when you hit someone's AC, you don't necessarily hit them physically. I mean, maybe you do. Maybe you hit their shield, or maybe you hit their sword, but they glance it off. Or maybe you do hit them. Maybe you favor just these enormous heroes who can take slices and dices and bashes and get back up and keep going. I've always found that concept pretty difficult to imagine. The way I see it is that HP represents the totality of that person's chance to live. And so when you hit someone's AC, it means that maybe you did fire a laser at them. Maybe they do take HP, they do have to reduce their HP number, but that's not because they're injured right now. It simply means that their luck is running out. They dodged it that time, so they reduce their HP by 8. You can flavor it or not that they felt the laser singe the hairs on their arm as it passed. But the point is, for me at least, that they now have 8 less of a chance that the next time they get hit, that they get fired at, they'll be able to dodge it. And at some point, their HP is going to go way down into, like, the 5s and the 3s and the 0 range. And at that point, if they get hit, it's over for them. Which, obviously, is a little bit more more realistic, right? I mean, if you get hit by any number of things that hit people in the Dungeons & Dragons world, science fiction or not, you go down. So that's, for me, that's what HP often represents in my mind. It's just the probability of when is that final blow actually going to meet its mark. Speaking of all of that, especially AC, there is armor introduced in the technology guide. So there are things like a chameleon suit, for instance. And the chameleon suit, as you might think, is a suit of light woven fiber that covers the wearer from ankle to wrist and includes a hood and a cowl. Its surface consists of millions of tiny scale-like lenses and LED screens. When powered on, a chameleon suit analyzes its environment and changes, or rather generates, digital camouflage. So it's a bunch of screens on a suit that mimic its surroundings and projects the background onto the suit. Not really all that science fiction-y, to be honest. I think that sort of thing could probably be done today. I remember, I think I saw something that actually did that in real life, but it was on an internet video, so I have no idea if it was actually true or not. But obviously the proof of concept wouldn't be that hard to drum up in this day and age. The wearer gains a +10 competency bonus on stealth checks and can hide in plain sight. as a ranger in his favor in favored terrain. The crafting DC for that is 29. The cost for it is 7,500 gold pieces. There's quite a bit of armor in the technology guide, and granted, the Starfinder core rulebook has a wider variety of armor, and specifically there's a suit in the Starfinder core rulebook that has a spell reflector quality to it, which I thought was pretty brilliant, and I think would be fun to bring into a Pathfinder setting. Something that a soldier could wear, or anyone could wear, that would increase their ability to, well, that would protect them from various spells, I think is a really intriguing idea. Some spell resistance, or the chance to resist a spell. I quite like that. Weaponry is a lot of fun in the technology guide, and there's a lot of familiar stuff here. Taking an easy example would be the Arc Pistol, which if you have the Starfinder core rulebook, you recognize probably right away. There are some differences, there are some interesting differences. So the Arc Pistol, for instance, price is 10,000 gold pieces in the technology guide. It's a one-handed weapon, just like in Starfinder. Proficiency exotic firearms. And the damage for a small arc pistol is 1d6 electricity damage. And for a medium-sized arc pistol is 1d8 electricity damage. And that's a unique thing about both the technology guide and the Starfinder guide, is that weapons come in different sizes. There's small and then there's medium. And the reason for that is pretty obvious, I think. I mean, you would assume that a tiny creature like a gnome, or even a halfling, a small creature. I don't suppose a gnome is actually a tiny creature, sorry, small creature, would not do well with a large pistol, for instance. So having a small version of that just makes sense. The interesting thing mechanically is that these small versions actually do less damage, which is kind of funny, and I don't feel like it's technologically accurate. If anything, it would be reversed, right? The big old version of technology would do less damage than the smaller, better version, if Moore's Law has anything to say about it. But in this universe, it's not true. The small version is less powerful. It does 1d6 electricity damage. The larger one, the medium-sized version of it, is 1d8. Critical effect is x2, and then the range is 50 feet. And then there's a capacity of 10 and a usage of 1. Usage is 1 charge. And what that means is that when you fire this thing, you use up 1 charge. It is semi-automatic, and it is basically a touch attack. Or I assume a ranged touch attack. And that's kind of interesting too, because obviously in the technology guide, in the fantasy world, you don't have different types of AC. Whereas, I mean, you do, you have AC and then touch AC, but in Starfinder, you've got the different kinds of, you've got the kinetic AC and the energy AC. So you don't have that differentiation in the Pathfinder setting, which makes it kind of interesting to think about how you're going to not get hit by these things, because it all goes off of basically just touch AC or AC, which I guess is why you would want anti-technology anti-technology magic or armor. So in the Starfinder core rulebook, arc pistol static uses, doesn't fit on the page, uses, it's a second level weapon. And it uses, it's a 50-foot range, it uses 2 charges, that's what I was looking for, 2 charges when you fire it, and it holds 20 charges. I'm not sure what the difference there is. I don't know why they increased it that way, because previously, or in the technology guide rather, it was 10 charges and 1 use. So I'm not quite sure what the mathematical advantage is of just boosting it by two each. But anyway, that's what they did. So it's pretty similar from Starfinder to Pathfinder. The arc pistol static simply does 1d6 electric damage, and that's it. It has a special effect of stunning an opponent, and it costs a mere 750 credits. There are more substantial versions of arc pistols. There's the arc pistol Aurora and the arc pistol Storm, which are much higher level weapons, a lot more expensive, and they do things like 3d6 damage and 3d12 damage. And I'm assuming that's really just to deal with higher level play, is probably what that's for, which I doubt the technology guide really had to worry about. More overlap all over the place, really, but one of my favorites is the zero pistol, or I think in the Starfinder guide, let me switch over to that really quick. I think the Starfinder, yeah, it's called Frostbite Class Zero Pistol, but it's basically the same idea. They don't look the same. Like, the drawing is actually different, the art is different, but the idea is the same. This is a 10,000 gold piece pistol in the technology guide. It's one-handed. Damage for a medium size is 1d8, damage for a small is 1d6. Capacity is 10, usage 1 charge. And again, that just means that when you fire it, you use 1 charge rather than, for instance, 2 or 10. A zero pistol fires a beam of freezing particles at high velocity, dealing cold damage to anything it strikes. Any creature critically hit by a zero pistol ray must succeed at a DC 15 fortitude saving throw or become staggered by the cold for one round. So cool. I really like that one. And the comparison there would be the Frostbite Class Zero Pistol, as I said. It's a small, one-handed weapon. Category is cryo. Damage 1d6 cold. Critical, you get the staggered effect. So there are minor differences here and there, but the feel and some of the names are exactly the same. I could go on and on, but I won't because there's just so much in the technology guide. And I haven't even really talked about cybertech or just generic tech gear or the pharmaceuticals or all the different kind of tech hazards that your players could come up against. There is just so much. As I said, this is actually a fairly short book for a Paizo product. It's only about 68 pages. But after the initial introduction to the concept of, hey, there's technology in your fantasy world now. Here's how to overcome that mental block that you had that disallows that. It's just a book of stuff. It's a gear guide. It is equipment nonstop. So if you are looking to integrate technology into your fantasy world, the technology guide is probably you want it to be your first stop. And frankly, I don't see why you couldn't get the technology guide no matter what you're playing. If you're not playing Pathfinder and you are playing D&D, get the book, adapt it a little bit for your game. It's worth it, especially if that's what you want. If it's not worth it for the stats, which it may not be, it is worth it for the idea and the skinnability of everything. Because as the introduction itself says, you can take any piece of technology and reskin it as magic, or you can take magic and reskin it as technology, and it's a drop-in modification to a standard setting. So why do I like technology in a fantasy setting so much? Well, as I said, I don't actually always like it. It's not something that I default to. It's just something that sometimes I do happen to like. I think the effect that it has on players is that it provides the people in your world access to essentially magic without demystifying magic in any way. There's a common complaint or a common a common thought exercise, maybe, where players and DMs, especially of D&D, think about how magic could possibly exist in even an imaginary world and just not completely break everything. And it's really, really tricky to make magic seem special in a setting where we all know magic happens all the time. And we don't know that necessarily from experiencing it in the game. I mean, if you really think about games, there's like a lot of times where magic doesn't really happen. And when it does happen, it doesn't feel very magical. Someone casts a prestidigitation spell and suddenly the place is cleaned up. That's not really all that magical. We can imagine that happening anyway. It just wouldn't be called a prestidigitation spell. It would just be called cleaning up the area really fast. Things like that. It's not super magical, right? And you don't... People don't use levitation spells to pass the salt at dinner time. It's just not something that happens throughout the game. So when it does happen, and it does seem magical because you disintegrate a foe with one spell at a time when it seems like there was not going to be a way to escape this problem, then it seems magical. So the fear for people very frequently is that if they hand out magic items too often, then no longer will it seem special. It doesn't seem magical anymore. If everyone has a wand of healing, and everyone has a ring of invisibility, and everyone has a sword +1, and so on. We want our magic to feel magical, and part of the magic is that there is no explanation for it. Now, as I've said, that sounds a lot like technology, because for a lot of us, there's no real explanation that has any meaning to us as to why a computer turns on and shows us graphics at some point. That's magic to us, but it doesn't feel magical because we know it's technology, it's very common, it's just not special. But something truly magical feels magical, and I feel like introducing technology into a fantasy setting is one way to provide everyday, quote-unquote, magic without harming and in fact helping to preserve the mystique of actual magical spells. Case in point is this Frostbite Class 0 pistol, as they call it in Starfinder. It's this laser ray gun that you point at something and you fire it and it freezes it. It sends out a cold blast to that person. So you, a non-spell-casting person who happened to take this technologist feat, or maybe you just happened to pick up this weapon, you've just fired it at something, and you've dealt cold damage, and it delivers the same effect as a frost spell. But the wizard who has specialized in frost magic, in ice magic, can do the same thing from the palm of their hand. And there is a difference there. Even though the end result is basically the same, there is absolutely a difference, and everyone is aware of it. One was manifested out of nothingness, from just the core of this person's being, or from the magical weave that makes up the universe. And the other is dependent upon hardware. And hardware, however magical it may seem sometimes because it works and does things, we all know it's not magic. It's a construct. It's something that someone built. We don't understand how it works. Its effects are mysterious to us. It's not magic. And that little bit of flavor separates magic from technology enough such that technology doesn't actually invade on the preciousness of magic in your setting, and yet it provides the same kind of flavorful power to those who are not magical. It's a great way to have your cake and eat it too. Your players will enjoy it, It's a lot of fun as long as everyone is on board with the idea that you're in a fantasy world with technology. And if they're not into that idea, sit them down for an episode of He-Man. They're quick episodes. They're silly. They're Saturday morning cartoons from the 80s. But if they like that feel, if they like the idea that in this magical kingdom there are people wielding both swords and flying on hovercraft, it just totally somehow makes sense. It totally works. And for some reason, the person with the sword can defeat that person firing a laser at them, and no one ever questions it. It's a great mix of sci-fi and fantasy. It provides for a really unique world. It's a lot of fun. Try it out. I'll put a link to the technology guide in the show notes. And of course, there's also Starfinder itself. There's plenty of material out there for you to glean ideas from and to codify into rules in your actual game. Well worth looking at. Thanks for listening. Talk to you next time. That's it for this week's episode. Thank you very much for listening. My name is Klaatu. You can reach me via email at klaatu@member.fsf.org. You can also usually catch me in IRC as not Klaatu. I'm on the Freenode network. Thank you very much for listening, and I'll talk to you next time.